okay. Brace yourselves. If you were at a book signing, celebrating your long-awaited mystery, and at that book signing found a dead body, well, if you're amateur sleuths like Charles and Carrie, you start a hunt for that murderer. Now, I've got an author I'd like you to meet whose characters face danger and unexpected twists as they search for answers. Oh, and while they're on this search, before discovering the murderer, they uncover historical secrets about their city's founding. Stick around because we're going to learn more about her book and the writing process she followed to create it.
Welcome to a Book Finds You podcast. This week's guest is Flo McCann. Join us as she shares the inspiration behind her book, along with her writing process, routines, and challenges. And now, here's your host, best-selling author, Rob Jollis.
Flo McCann writes the Faraday Murder series featuring amateur sleuths Carrie and Charles Faraday under the pseudonym Millie Mack. She recently completed her first culinary mystery for her new Irish Bistro Murder series. In addition to her mystery books, Millie also writes a blog about mysteries at darkandstormynights.com. Happy to have you with us and welcome to the show, Flo and Millie, but we'll talk to Flo for right now.
Hi, Rob.
Good to have you here. And so let's dive right in. I want to talk about that book. You know the name of the show, so how did this latest book find you?
Well, I like to tell people that I do murder. And the way I write is I always have an idea of a murder. So I start with the murder, and then I build the book around the murder. Now, of course, this is book five, so some of the things I already have done. You know, I have my series, I have my little town, I have many of the characters who reappear. But that's how I start the writing process. I start with a murder.
So in a sense, you know, because it's funny, I'd say I'm about 50-50 on talking to authors when I ask them, do you begin with the end in mind? And half of them go, oh, absolutely not. But it sounds like if you start with the murder, kind of you're kind of beginning with the end in mind.
Somewhat, but I will tell you one little funny story here. On my first book, I was writing away and I had the murder. And in the first book, Carrie comes back to her hometown. She hasn't yet married Charles. But they worked together on this first murder. And I was up to about chapter 39 out of 45. And I didn't know who'd done it. And I'm working through this thinking, come on, you know, I've only got a few more chapters. I've got my characters. And then believe it or not, I read an article in the Sun Papers about a fraudulent caviar coming into the docks of Baltimore. And it like just kicked it off. And suddenly I knew what was going on. Picked the bad guy was. And the other part of the funny story is when I sent it to my editor, she said, well, you fooled me because I really thought it was so-and-so, but then this happened to that person. So then I thought it was so-and-so, but it wasn't that person either. And I think it all had to do with the fact that I had no idea who'd done it until like chapter 40.
That's extraordinary, really. I mean, it really is. It's funny. We start a new show, How a Murderer Finds You, because in a sense, you know, you didn't find the murderer. It kind of found you just the way the books do. That's hysterical. How about the pseudonym? Why the pseudonym?
Well, my last name, it's pronounced McCann, but it has kind of an unusual spelling. So this is my marketing. I was in marketing for 45 years, put on my marketing hat, and I thought, is anybody going to spell this correctly to find me? And then the other thing is it really kind of honors my mother, because when I was growing up, my mother and I used to sit and watch mystery movies together. And so she was the one that got me interested in mysteries. And I might also add, she was a librarian and she tended to read the end of the book first if it was a mystery. And then we'd go back and read the book to see if the author played true and fair with the reader, that the clues were there. But anyway, her name was Mildred. So that's where the Millie comes from. Oh. And when we were growing up, kids, our friends had trouble saying our name, too. So she used to just say, oh, call me Mrs. Mack. Thus, yeah, Millie Mack.
There you go. You know, I it's funny. I was asking the question because I knew for one thing, you didn't just go, well, I spun the wheel and there it was. Even the pseudonym finds you.
That's right.
For you, because you construct a little bit differently, how do you know when an idea is worth pursuing? Because according to you, I mean, you've got a game plan. I can hear it. You're basically just trying to tie it up, figure out how to tie it up. But how do you know whether an idea or a mystery is worth pursuing?
I think what happens with, especially with a series, is you first looked at whether the murder and what is happening works with your characters. So I have a husband and wife team who work, you know, have their jobs in a small town. And therefore, when something happens, it has to relate back to what they do in that small town. Is it something that affects, you know, where they live? So in the latest book, the dead body is found at the book signing, but they discover the woman was a professor at the college. Happens to be the same college that Carrie went to. And her mentor happens to be the same mentor that Carrie had when she went to the school. So then that's how things start to grow and kind of build. So, and the other thing that a lot of authors don't do, which I do, which can really be annoying at certain times, is I write chapters as opposed to writing the book. So like I had the idea about, oh, hey, this woman, the murder victim's a professor at the college. Let me write the scene that has to do with the college. So I write the scene with the college. Then it turns out I was doing some genealogy on my own personal family. And that's where it works into the story. This particular history professor also does genealogy. So we discover that one of the families she was doing the genealogy for was one of the founding families of my fictional town of Tri-City. So then I start bringing in my genealogy and I write some chapters about genealogy and what that would involve. Well, it's called Tri-City, and I created this in the first book. It's called Tri-City because there were three different villages that came together to form the city. Well, there were representatives from those other villages. So now I've got a chapter about that particular founder, this particular founder, and I end up with all these kind of loose, not necessarily connected chapters. And then you start to go back and you start to thread it. And again, sometimes I'm challenging myself to figure out, you know, who done it.
Right. Is this the way mystery writers write, or is this the way you and your buddy Millie write?
A lot of the mystery writers I know do tend to write in chapters. Some write where they outline. You know, we've got this old pantser and plotter methodology for how do you write. Clearly, I'm a pantser because I'll have an idea and I get down that particular chapter. Other of my friends do the plotting routine and they work through it. You know, they know from chapter one. And they outline it and outline and outline it. I don't do that. And some of the others that don't follow that format is I've kind of like the spontaneity that occurs, just like with the first book, where something happened and it turned out the person I had been writing the book about who I thought did it, something happens. And suddenly, you know, you've heard this phrase, your characters take over. Suddenly a character takes over or somebody comes out of the blue, or I'll sit there and say, oh, wait, this works. Let me try that. Now, yes, there are some, you know, I do go down some rabbit holes where I get down that rabbit hole when I'm like, oh, this isn't working. Get rid of that. Or something that I had at the beginning seems to fit now better at the end. So there is a lot of manipulation, but, you know, it's kind of those of us that are pantsers tend to write that way.
Yeah. You took the question right out of my mouth because I'm seeing myself painting a room and painting myself into a corner and not being able to get out of the room. And you know, as a high school guy who was painting over the summer, I did that a few times. So I'm a guy who outlines the whole thing. And you know, and I go through expansion and I go through contraction. And I'm always allowing it to continue to expand if need be. You never just put a guardrail on anything, I don't believe, as a writer. I don't care if it didn't make the outline or not. If it's coming to us, you know, and knocking at our brain, it's there for a reason. But by doing the chapter thing, you take that risk of going down that rabbit hole. But it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're not really painting yourself into a corner. You've got a little, almost a chapter that's gnawing at you, that's painting you into a corner, and you can, you're repairing a chapter, not a manuscript. I have that right?
Yes. And then sometimes you realize as you're writing that something has to happen. So then you step back because, you know, it's a mystery. There has to be, you know, the red herrings and the clues and all like that. So suddenly you reach a point where you say, wait a minute, I need somebody else in this chapter. I need to introduce this. How do I introduce that? Do right. I introduce a character? Do I introduce a problem where they're suddenly faced with a confrontation with somebody? So that's how it begins to build. But you kind of, like I said, you know the murderer. and you know there's been this murder, and basically you're working it towards that. I'd also like to mention that the type of mysteries I write are called cozies. Now, that means there's no blood and gore, there's no car chases, there's no bullets flying around like in a police procedural. So it's known as a cozy, and that comes out of the Agatha Christie Golden Age of mysteries. Now, those writers were referred to as traditional mystery writers, but when the genre sort of came back in the 60s, they started referring to them as cozies. And there are some rules. And some of the rules include, number one, playing fair with the reader. So I can't have in chapter 30, a character that's never been introduced, not part of the plot, suddenly be the person who did it.
Right.
So you've got that in mind, that you know that you have to, in this first book where I didn't know who did it, I did have to do some rewriting to make sure that person had a bigger part and got introduced earlier in the book. But you introduce the villain, if you will, early on. And then the concept is that in Agatha Christie's tradition, you gather the suspects and all the, you know, and you start to point out what you've learned about each suspect. Now, it doesn't have to be in the traditional where they're all in a parlor and you confront them. It can be Harry and Charles discovering something about each suspect. But that's part of it, too, is you know you're going to have these suspects, and there has to be suspects in each chapter, and you'll learn a little bit about it. And if you're playing fair with the reader, the little clues that you're putting out there, the reader is getting, too. So by the time you get to the end, the reader should be right there with you and know who did it. Now, they also have some other, you know, crazy rules that came out of the this is what they called the detection club that came out of England. And they had some crazy rules like, you know, you can only have one secret passage in a book. And, you know, you can't go through the whole book. This is, again, playing fair with the reader. And then suddenly at the end, some Chinese gang or some mafia group has done the deed. It's got to be part of the construction. But I suggest our listeners take a look at the detection club and read some of those early rules. Like I said, some of them are a little off the wall, but others are still being followed today in terms of the mystery genre.
Yeah. That's absolutely fascinating. You're my first mystery writer, and I had no idea there were rules. But as you go over the rules, they make complete sense to me. Because as a reader, I wouldn't pick up another one of your books if you just dropped a character in. And, you know, we see TV shows and movies like that, where we go, what, did they change writers? Which frequently they have, or something. I don't know if you remember years ago, maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago, whatever it was, when ABC came out with a show called Lost. And it was a phenomenal first season. But it's almost like what you're describing, where I don't believe they thought they were going to get to a second season. And so when they did, they were writing things that, for the viewers, felt almost unfair. Like, this really couldn't be based on what you've showed me and taught me. You can't just do that. Only so we sit there and we'd lose interest. So I guess it makes sense. Quick question. The historical secrets part, okay, seems like you having some fun. Any rules against that? Are you allowed to, in your mystery, drop in a few historical secrets?
Sure, because, you know, it's my fictional city, so I can talk about how it was developed. And of course, as we learn early on in the book, well, there were three founding families. One family is still very prominent. The other family, all the descendants have passed away, or so we think. And then the other family, the third family, the original founder, had no interest in continuing and being part of the city. However, it involved money. And of course, in mysteries, money is always a motive for murder. So that's where the historical secrets come in, because, again, that's how I'm introducing characters, because they discover somebody from one of the families and they interview that person, and then they become a possible suspect. And then they find somebody from the other family. And of course, there's all kinds of little things happening where, well, so-and-so could have done that, or so-and-so could have done this. And the murdered woman also has a sister. How was she involved in all this? So that's how you start to build this. And you build the characters. And the best news, at least for me as an author, and I had somebody come up to me after the recent book and said, "You got me. I really thought it was so-and-so. I couldn't believe when it turned out to be so-and-so." And yet the clues were there, because this person said, "Once I knew who did it, I realized you had told us all along how it was going to end." And to me, that's what it's all about. That means I did my job. I put the clues out there. I had a few red herrings that had people going off in the wrong direction. But then at the end, they were willing to accept who did it, what happened, because it was following actually a process.
That's really interesting to me. Let's talk about your writing routine a little bit. You seem to be a contrarian. Let's see how you do as a routine. Is there a daily routine? When you decide, like, you've got another one you're starting to work on, it sounds like. And once you kind of mentally launch, what does it look like?
I'll be honest. Someone taught me, I attended one of our conferences, and one of the speakers talked about doing more writing, getting more writing done by recording. So I took to heart what she said and went out and bought a little, what they call a little digital recorder. It's about the size of a pack of cigarettes, only not quite as fat. And I get up, when I wake up, I guess the little leprechauns during the night are in there working in my brain, because a lot of times when I wake up at 6, 7 in the morning, I don't want to go get on the computer. I'm not ready for a day on the computer. So I get out my little digital recorder. And I literally record scenes, I record dialogue, I record thoughts, like, don't forget to do this, or remember you said that. So I have it on a digital recorder, and it's very simple. All I do is I take my recorder, I bring up the Word program, I hit the microphone, and I just play my recorder, and good old Microsoft types away and basically copies what I've said into the recorder. Is it perfect? No, because it doesn't always pick up whatever accent I have. It doesn't always pick up the wording. But the next step is then when I get to my desk, I've got something to work with. So I start to manipulate what I've put into the recording. I start to make it right and make the dialogue right and put in the little quote marks and all that stupid stuff. And that's usually like a launch pad. Now, that's not to say I don't sit at the computer and type, you know, out of the blue from sitting at the computer and coming up with ideas. But I found that using the digital recorder allows me to get a lot more down, a lot more to work with than if I was just sitting staring, as they say, staring at the blank page.
And now you're the second author in 2 weeks for me who is using a video recorder. And so I'm really starting to look at that. The other author I spoke to actually just takes walks, but is recording during that walk. And that's her routine. By the way, that accent of yours, I'm picking up some Baltimore. Where's that accent from? It is a hodgepodge.
Well, a lot of it's from Philadelphia.
Okay.
And, you know, we say dumb words like cooperate.
Right.
And, you know, things like that. So, yeah, I'm sure I've been in Baltimore long enough, hon, that I probably have a few of the Baltimoreese in there, too. But, yeah, Microsoft and I go back and forth with, what's wrong with you? This is a normal word, but they'll fill in things that are like, so that's why I say it's not perfect, because it, what would be funny is just to take what I recorded and like publish it, and people would just go crazy on what the heck's going on here. But anyway, it's a good way to get, for me, it's a great way to get the morning started.
That sounds
as
great.
As opposed to the blank page.
Yeah. Do you work with a word count or page count per week, or just let it go as it goes?
I let it go as it goes. I don't deal with writer's block because usually I have multiple projects. Like right now I have 3 books running. Mm. So if I get stuck with the one thing, or a short story, I'll go off and work on the other one, because in the meantime, I've had some ideas about that particular piece. And that's how I avoid writer's block. I go back and forth between the different pieces I'm working on.
Yeah. You almost sound like, and my wife is an artist and she's a collage artist and she works on multiple pieces. And I always say it's like watching her play 3 chess games at once, where she's at the board and looking at it and making some moves, and then goes to the next one. It sounds like you're sort of, not that you're moving that quickly, but that you kind of set up for 3, so you have the ability to pivot.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I'll give you an example. I was stuck. I'm actually working on book 6 in the Faraday murder series, mm-hmm. and it has to do with antiques. And I'm taking an antiques class. So this is where I bring in something I'm doing and what little bit of knowledge I have on the antiques. But I always have people that know what they're doing as my backup and as my source thing. But I was looking for a place to hide some gems. And I was down and clearing out my club room a little bit. And I found one of those old cases with the little drawers where you put screws and things like that. And I thought, hey, this is great. You know, I can hide the gems in this silly little case because it has like 3 sections. I come back the next day and I write a whole chapter about this stupid little screw holder that I'm hiding gems in. So that's sometimes you just fall into something. And then for me, I want to get that down so I don't lose it. And again, it might not show up in this book, but it's out there in case I need it somewhere else.
Right. I actually do use a tape recorder, and I use my, you know, my smartphone. Most of them all have recorders that are with them. But I'm more of just, it's more outline ideas. It's as I've got an outline and something pops in, an analogy, a story, a quote, a poem, something. That's the one I want to make sure I don't miss. But when I hear it once about recording and writing a recording, I think it's interesting. When I hear it twice, I think it's worth trying. So I'm actually going to, I'll report back to you, but I'm actually going to give that a try. It sounds...
Well, sometimes I keep it right next to my bed. So yeah. Like if I wake up, they always said writers always keep a pen and paper. It's basically the same thing because I can reach over there and just turn it on. And the particular recorder I have, I guess it's a little more advanced because you can actually do folders. So I can put things in particular folders to bring up later. Otherwise, when I wake up, I'm like, what was that great idea I had last night? Gosh, right. Where is it? I can't remember. Where this way?
Yeah. Well, that's why I've always kept something by my bed, because when we are in writing mode, you better keep it there, particularly the one that hits you at 3 a.m.
Uh-huh.
Because you'll swear to yourself. It's like a dream. Oh, I'll remember this. How am I going to even forget it? There was something you really wanted to remember and there was no way you could forget it, but fool me 7 times, shame on me. It takes a while because you'll swear, you know, at that mythical 2, 3, 4 o'clock hour that you're going to remember this thought. It's just too vivid, but it will slip away. So you do have to keep a pad, a recorder, something by the bed.
And because the other thing is that when you wake up and you're like, now, what was that? I can't remember it. And then you're like hitting yourself because it was the best thought you've ever had in your entire life.
Yeah.
And you can't remember what it is.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. How about the publishing process? First of all, you have a set publisher, or do you move around?
I actually started with the first book because at the time I needed to get it out. So I started self-publishing.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is when you have a series, if you've self-published, you then can't take that particular series back to what you would call a more traditional publisher.
Right.
The new series I'm working on, I am going to try and query a more traditional, maybe a hybrid, but a more traditional type of publisher. So then as I got smarter, as I published more books, I basically then set up my own company. So I now publish under my own company's name, which is my website, Dark and Stormy Nights.
Got it. And so how about the marketing promotion of it?
I spent 40 years in marketing.
Mm.
And I was a hotshot. You know, I knew marketing. I worked for financial institutions and I pretty much knew everything about marketing financial products. I'm kidding, of course. But I marketed for 45 years. And then after I retired and I'm starting to do book marketing, it's like, oh my heavens, what is this? You know, and all the nuances of marketing a book. So over the last 10 years, I've learned a lot. In fact, I do a course on marketing for authors because there are just so many things that are kind of different in terms of how do you reach that particular audience? You know, for instance, I know in my genre, cozy mysteries, it tends to be women over 55. Now, that's not to say somebody at 10 or 12 won't read the book. It's not to say that a guy won't read the book, but your target audience is women over 55. So then it becomes a whole marketing thing of how do you find women that are over 55? And, you know, that's a challenge for anybody. So that's the one thing where I am not a pantser. I am very much a plotter. And I will plot out my marketing plan for the year of what I'm going to do, whether I'm giving a presentation, whether I'm going to an event, whether I'm talking to this great guy, Rob. Have you heard of him? He does a podcast. If I'm talking to him, that's part of the plan where I can. And then, of course, you know, the other thing is we used to call it in banking ROI, return on investment. But that means you go back and you look and like, did this event work? Like I attended an event in Ocean City. Kind of out of the blue for, you know, hey, let's go to Ocean City. And it was at a hotel and it's the first time they ever did it as a holiday thing for authors. And I sold 27 books. Well, that's like huge. You know, you can do a book signing in a bookstore and not sell 27
right.
books. So again, I know what my return was. And clearly that's an event I will go back to next year. But yes, marketing is a challenge for everyone, including the folks that are with traditional publishers. Because unless you're who? Lisa Scott Aline or Mary Higgins Clark, you're not getting book tours and things like that. So even authors with traditional publishers are having to figure out ways to market their books.
Right. Well, and I'm glad you brought that up because I use traditional publishers and it looks good, but you got a nice little 23, 24 year old person who's on pretty much their first job. That's the book marketing end of Simon & Schuster. And, they'll send out a few hundred kind of proposals, get you three or four reviews, one or two placements, and it really falls into the author's lap. So conventional hybrid self-publish, I think everybody needs to remind themselves that we fight for our books. That really doesn't, that's not really what you're giving up or getting with a conventional publisher. Distribution, maybe, but marketing, forget it. We have to do it on our own. So let's you and I, let's do something. Let's swap just one idea. I'll give you a book marketing idea. I'm actually trying to think of one now. If I had to pick one and cherry pick, give me one of your better book marketing tips, all right? Idea that's worked for you, and I'll throw one back at you. You go first.
I only put the ebook version with Amazon. Why? Because they have 76% of the ebook marketing. The other thing, and this is what I've learned, this is my marketing tip. With Amazon, I can go into my account, and I can change the price. So I have used companies like Reading Deals. And Reading Deals, you pay a small fee, you get your book out there, they send it out to generally over 30,000 readers. And the gist is that if you get this book at a reduced price, you as the reader will then turn around and give a review. Aha. We all know how important reviews are. Yep. So that's one of the marketing tips that I've learned. And the advantage that I have over some folks that are with a traditional publisher is the fact that I can go in there and change it, because the deal with Reading Deals is the ebook price has to be cheaper than what it would normally be. So if my ebook is $4.99 on Amazon, I can go in and make it 99 cents for whatever the period of time is in order to take advantage of that special. So that would be one of my marketing things that I've learned.
It's a good one. Yeah, you're pushing me to a wall here. All right, I'll go with a forward, and I mean looking for someone that's a few notches above you to consider writing a forward. You'll be surprised at how many authors that may be, like I said, a few steps higher up on the food chain that are thinking for 600-700 words, I wouldn't mind being on the cover in this Millie Mack show here. It's not a perfect science. And that's why I said, let's just cherry pick, because we probably each of us have, I think there's at least 30 or 40 legitimate ways to market. And it depends on, you hit it right out of the gate. Who am I marketing to? What kind of book is it? What genre am I looking at? But so I never want to fall in love with just one idea, but I think people, they forget that a forward is worth pursuing. Even if you get the answer no, then go down the line. And some of those authors that you listed, who knows? If they might want to throw 500 words your way. The nice thing is, Flo, if they do write it, when somebody searches them, frequently our name will come up, and vice versa. So, every book I've had, I've stepped up the forward each time to somebody a little bit higher up.
Says one, like, can't do it this time. Imagine how bad they'll feel when the book becomes such a success and someone else's name is in the forward.
Yeah. Well,
think positive.
Yeah. And one last thing, we each said one, but together, I think we could agree on this. Have a book launch. Launch that book. Think people, because remember when you just mentioned those reviews? If we bring our tribe into that launch, we should be starting with 25 reviews right out of the gate. And the only thing I recommend to people and want to remind them is we think at a book launch that it's designed to hand everybody copies of our book. I'll hand people a poster of me, whatever you want. I'll give you tuna fish sandwiches. I actually have an open bar. I'll take good care of you. The one thing I won't do is give you one of my books, because I can't get a verified review from you if I do. So I'll be happy if you bring in your book to sign it. You bring in a book, I'll give you a book. Give it to your uncle. But if you're my aunt, my uncle, my cousin, my brother, my colleague, the ones I know I can get a review from, I really hope people think twice about making that the free books we're going to give away.
Well, that's the other thing is because, again, of controlling my price. For instance, so I did what's known as a soft launch. In other words, I didn't have one day. I did it over a period of time. Knowing, again, my audience, I kind of concentrated my launch on, well, first of all, my local library has a reading club. And it's almost, well, I'd say 99% women and almost all over 55. So right there's my target audience. So they were kind enough to let me launch it at one of the book club meetings. And of course, I gave them a reduced price. Well, now those ladies, I'm running into them in the grocery store and they're coming back and said, oh, I read your book. And I'm like, oh, good. Well, are you going to put a review up for me? Remind review. The other thing, again, for my particular audience, and this has to do with knowing who your audience is senior centers. So I've been all over the place at senior centers and talking to them. Of course, I don't go in to pitch the book. I talk to them about cozy mysteries. I talk to them about the tradition of mysteries and some of the rules that are involved. Well, again, I'm getting Millie's name out there so that when they go to the library or they get on Amazon or they see a reading deal come up for a cheaper price, hopefully they're going to snap up my book.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I want everybody to know that Flo has been like a soldier on this podcast because she is battling a cough and battling beautifully. So let's bring ourselves in for a landing so you can save that voice of yours. But I want you to know, I really appreciated you talking to me and sharing some of these tips with you. How do people get a hold of you?
Well, they can go to they can go to the website. They can also get me at MillieMack@Verizon.net. They can get me at Flo McCann. I won't give you that email because it's one of those that get assigned to make sure nobody can steal it. But right. It goes on and on forever. And then, of course, being an active member of Maryland Writers, I'm actually the membership chair. So they can get me at membership@MarylandWriters.org.
Perfect. And that website is darkandstormynights.com, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Or great. It can be, I actually own. This is, again, something I learned as I snapped everything up. So I have, you can get me at darkandstormynightmysteries.com or darkandstormynights.com. I have both.
You're a marketing machine. You and Millie. Well, listen, congratulations on the books. Thanks for those tips. Some really good stuff. So, and that's what I love about this show. A, we learn about what somebody's working on in their book and how it finds them. And I hope that inspires people who are listening. But B, you hear that everybody's got their own kind of way of putting an idea together. There's no right way. There's no wrong way. Well, there's a few wrong ways, but there's really no right way to do it. And, but here is a guy I've been writing for, 35 years, 40 years, whatever. I'm telling you, you're giving me that nudge to at least try recording and see how that works for me. So I appreciate that. I hope other people picked up some ideas as well. In any case, thanks so much for coming on, Flo. Really enjoy our conversation. Thanks for soldiering up and battling through that call for yours.
Appreciate the opportunity. It's been great because I've been learning. I love the back and forth because I've been learning stuff too, and that's what it's all about.
Good. Particularly on the marketing side. Well, we got to, all of us, you know what happens? We bust our tail writing the book, and it's almost like we get tired and go, the marketing. Now, that's where you really got to kick in. You got to, you work so hard for those characters, for that book, that mystery. Keep going. Market those books. And so you might even want to stop in at that website because here Flo's telling you that she's got some ideas and tips and teaches book marketing. So maybe you reach out to her as well. Any case, thanks so much. Pleasure
Thank
meeting
you for
Really
listening.
Great having you on.
If you enjoyed
you
today's
Rob,
guest author, we'd love you to
well,
write,
we'll do it again as
review,
well as we can next time, everybody. Until
others.
Then.
If you'd like more information on today's guest or the Maryland Writers Association, please visit our website at MarylandWriters.org. You can also find out about the history of the Maryland Writers Association by listening to our first podcast, Episode 0.